welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden years. Mark Thavonier, your host for an hour of science fiction. Later on, a story from 1958 on Exploring Tomorrow, but right now it's a broadcast of X-1 from NBC. The James Blish story, Surface Tension, is featured from August 28, 1956.
In just a moment, X-1. But first...
Once again, NBC Bandstand brings you some of the nation's top name bands in person. This week, Ralph Flanagan fills your weekday mornings with his wonderful hit tunes. Slow numbers are fast. There's no mistaking the delightful Flanagan style. And then, Art Mooney and his orchestra are also on hand with plenty of lively and rhythmic arrangements. The four lads take the Mr. Music spot this week, and Bert Parks is back as permanent MC. Hear them all on NBC Bandstand.
Now stay tuned for X-1 on NBC.
Countdown for blastoff. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight, Surface Tension by James Blish.
Come in, Professor. Come in.
Mr. President.
Do sit down. I'm terribly sorry to have kept you waiting.
Time has very little significance, sir.
Well, now, what is the urgent nature of your visit?
Mr. President, for some time now at the Nuclear Institute... A group of us have been making a study of a new star, which has entered our constellation.
Yes, the military advised me there was some disturbance.
We've completed our calculations, sir.
And?
Before I give you our results, let me tell you that we've been in touch with the Scientific Council of the Asian Confederation. They've verified the results.
I'm waiting, Professor.
Mr. President, the effect of this new star in our galaxy will be extremely catastrophic. At the rate it's expanding, it will cause the sun to explode.
The what?
The sun is going to explode.
But that means...
Exactly. The world will end in precisely 2 weeks and 7 hours.
This is incredible. Are you absolutely certain of these calculations?
Absolutely.
Does anyone know of this?
Well, as soon as we guessed where our study was leading us, we classified all information... The actual final results are known only to a small group of scientists here and in the Asian Confederation.
2 weeks and 7 hours. That would be September 4th, 2056.
At approximately 12 noon.
Is there anything to be done?
Nothing.
The other planets, Mars, Venus...
All will be destroyed. The universe as we know it will disintegrate.
And the race?
Will vanish.
It's impossible.
Those are the facts, Mr. President. How you choose to make them public, if you do choose to make them public, is a matter of government.
Yes, yes, of course. Has the president of the Asian Confederation been notified?
He's being notified at this moment.
I intend to take the following steps, Professor. First, I will contact the Asian Confederation. What's the name of their chief scientist?
Dr. Gorlick.
Yes. I'll propose that you and Dr. Gorlick be given every resource to find a method of preserving the race. You'll be flown to their laboratories by rocket ship in an hour.
I would like to spend these remaining days with my family.
Your family can accompany you.
They'll ask questions.
They should know better by now.
You will not release the information to the public.
I would prefer to keep it a complete secret. provided the Asians agree, of course. A public announcement would only create utter panic and chaos. I assume it will happen instantaneously?
Yes, instantaneously.
Then secrecy is best.
Well, one thing, Mr. President.
Yes?
I wonder if perhaps religious leaders should be told.
Professor, I believe in the power of God myself. I also believe that my single prayer can be heard by the Almighty just as well as if there were 10 million.
There will at least be two of us, Mr. President. I too will pray.
Dr. Gorlick?
Professor, how nice to meet you again. Do sit down, sit down.
Thank you.
Quite a problem, eh?
It's quite a problem.
If the rest of the world knew what we two know.
I feel they should be informed, nevertheless.
Well, that part of it is for the administrators. We have our own work.
Do you seriously believe that we have the remotest chance of solving this problem in the 2 weeks that remain for the universe to exist?
That depends on what you consider a solution, Professor.
Anything that will preserve the race.
In that case, we have a solution.
You're joking.
About so serious a matter? Hardly. But would you step over to the table, please? Now, if you will be so good, look into that eyepiece in front of you while I focus it. Will you tell me, please, what you see there?
Fascinating. Most unusual.
Would you be good enough to describe it?
Yes, of course. I see what looks like a section of a large swimming pool. Plant life. They're very tiny, and some kind of animal life, almost molecular in size.
Good. Now let me change the magnification.
Impossible.
Go on, please. Describe.
What? I see what looks like dogs, cats, a cow. All evidently swimming underwater in this medium. Wait. Yes, they seem to be dogs and cows and cats, except that they appear to have gill-like breathing apparatus.
Good, good.
It looks as if somehow these species have been mutated to live underwater.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I don't understand how this is possible. It would take hundreds of generations, thousands of years, possibly, to effect such a change, even with modern genetic control.
Ah, it is the key, Professor. Let me ask you another question.
Yes?
Would you estimate the size of these creatures?
I would say they're normal size.
And the size of the pool, as you call it?
A tank of quite enormous size. I cannot see the walls, but I assume they are there.
Good. Now, Professor, prepare yourself for a shock.
I've been a scientist too long to shock easily, Dr. Gorlick.
Nonetheless, you will be shocked to learn that what you have just been looking into is a single microscopic drop of water, less than a milligram.
A single drop of water?
Yes.
Those dogs and cats are microscopic?
Submicroscopic, smaller than a filterable virus.
This is incredible, Doctor.
Incredible, perhaps, but we have done it.
Ah.
We found a way to reduce the size of the original fertilized eggs through bombardment of the molecules. In this way, we can produce a full-sized dog that is infinitesimal.
And you believe this will help us solve our problem?
I am convinced of it.
What do you propose?
This is our plan. We will create submicroscopic humans. At the submicroscopic level, 1,000 generations can reproduce in the equivalent of a few seconds of time. In less than an hour, we can have a species of human that is capable of living underwater.
Gill breathers?
Precisely.
And then what?
Don't you see, my friend? In a single drop of water, we can reproduce as many human beings as now live in the city of New Chicago or Trans-Europa.
But when the sun explodes in 2 weeks' time, all life, even that in a single drop of water, must perish.
That is true, Professor. But remember this. To a submicroscopic species of human, 2 weeks would be the equivalent of some 20 million years on Earth. In other words, to these human beings, starting tomorrow, the species will have hundreds of thousands of generations, each living a full life, before the final explosion of the universe.
It's almost like playing God.
I am not a subscriber to the concept of God, Professor. I must say I'm slightly shocked to discover that you, a man of science...
believes in a creator? I do, Doctor.
In any event, will you help us go ahead with our experiment?
I have no choice.
Good. We'll begin tonight to produce the first species. Careful with the virus.
Here's the tube.
Now then, we'll place this in a drop of water underneath the lens of the microscope.
What about the evaporation and condensation of the drop?
All outside factors will be controlled. Temperature, humidity, and so on. Will you turn on the lens, please? Now, using the highest magnification, we'll be able actually to manipulate a single being with electron magnets. A sensation we would interpret, possibly, as we interpret a centrifugal force. Ready?
Ready.
Good. We begin the experiment. Time?
1900 hours, 56 minutes, 3 seconds. Coming up on 0.4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Observation. The first fertilized ovum, reduced to submicroscopic size, has begun to develop. Time?
1956, 20 seconds. Coming up on 2, 1, 0.
4 submicroscopic human beings have been reproduced. 2 appear to be males, 2 females. Time?
1956, 24.
Observation. 10 generations of submicroscopic humans have been reproduced. Web toes and fingers and elementary gill modifications have begun in response to submersion of species in highly oxygenated vapor. Time?
1956, 45.
100 generations have reproduced. Increased water in vapor has resulted in gill structure. Species now ready for total submersion in a droplet of water. Turn on the electron magnet. Now for the crucial part of the experiment. Total submersion.
Finish or die, I feel like a murderer.
The prolongation of the human race is at stake. It's a calculated risk.
Still...
steady. I am about to effect the transfer. Steady. Now. Done. Look in the microscope, quickly.
I can't find them.
Let me. Ah, they're alive and swimming around.
How many?
Thousands. We've done it, Professor. Inside that drop of water, human beings like you and me, except for their gills, are already beginning to establish a civilization that will last for them... millions of years.
And for us?
2 weeks to observe and wander, and then...
unless a miracle should occur.
Let us begin now. Time, please.
1900 hours, 56 minutes, 49 seconds, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Observation. The equivalent of a million years has already passed inside our droplet of water. Human life is firmly established.
Sir! Sir!
Come in, Lavin! Come in!
I swam down from the museum. I'm exhausted.
Rest yourself. Would you like some proto-steak?
No, thank you.
Breath of oxygen, perhaps? 100 proof, distilled from pure upper-level water.
A breath, perhaps. Ah...
Now then, I assume that you come about the place.
Yes. Naturally, the directors of the museum are most anxious.
I haven't completed the translation yet.
It's been 6 months.
Yes, I know that, but they're incomplete. One of them was evidently lost during the final battle with the Eaters.
Sure. Can you tell me off the record what you've already deciphered?
Well, first, let me warn you. These plates were prepared thousands of generations ago. They're highly romantic. What they tell us may be fantasy.
Oh, still, I'm fascinated. After all, the greatest archaeological discovery of all time, buried a million years in the ooze of the bottom.
Very well. The first line of the oldest plate reads as follows. It goes, "In the beginning, we were created..."
Created? What an extraordinary concept. By whom? What about evolution?
Yeah, let me finish. It goes, "We were created by men who are not as we are, but who are our ancestors all the same. They were caught in some disaster, and they made us and put us here in our universe so that the race of men might live on."
Ridiculous.
Perhaps.
Well, this supposes a universe other than ours.
The theory has been advanced before.
By fools.
Fools? Look at us, Lavin. Are we really suited to this universe? Our gills, our webbed feet... These are the product of evolution and adaptation, but the shape of our bodies, the way we swim...
Well, I'll admit there's some basis for the theory, but every experiment, every attempt to prove that anything exists outside, that the surface can be pierced...
According to the plates, the surface can be pierced. Listen to this passage. "There are three surfaces of the universe. The first is the bottom, where the water ends. The second is the thermocline, the dividing water between the bottom and the sky. The third is the surface film beyond which none can pass. And beyond the surface film... beyond the surface is the universe of the creators."
Well, the whole thing sounds like a parable or a song.
Whatever it is, remember this. Thousands of generations pondered the miracle of our existence before these plates were written.
Primitive.
Men.
You sound like a mystic, Char. To think that a scientist like yourself could believe in the existence of creators... Nonetheless, creators who were formed in our own image.
Or we in theirs.
I'm shocked. Truly.
I intend to complete the translation of the plates. I will pursue this project for the rest of my life, if necessary.
Time, Professor?
Second day, 14 hours, 6 minutes, 10 seconds.
Observation. The plates, which were inscribed with microscopic data by an earlier generation, have evidently been removed by a subsequent generation. Our study shows that a highly developed civilization is now living in the drop of water. Certain water organisms have been domesticated and underwater ships have been developed.
The meeting of the council is called to order. Gentlemen, you all know the topic. Our speaker will be Char.
Gentlemen, some 28 time units ago, when I was a much younger man, I was given the privilege of translating some metal plates found buried in the bottom. As all of you know, I've devoted much of my life to convincing the world that travel through the surface film was not only possible but necessary to survive. Finally, the council has seen fit to grant my request for a special ship to accomplish this travel. I'm deeply grateful, and I would like to request my friend Lavin as head engineer for this project.
Permission is granted. We wish you luck. The whole of our world will be following your expedition.
What's happening, Dr. Gorlick?
From what I can detect, the Gilbreeders are preparing for the equivalent of space travel. A large cylindrical ship is being built.
What method of power are they using?
I can barely detect it through the microscope, but my guess would be that they will use some form of living creatures to power the vessel.
Char to leader. Char to leader.
Leader, go ahead, Char.
The ship is ready to take off for the upper levels, leader.
Water sealed in?
All tight.
Tie-Tom's ready to move?
Tie-Tom's ready.
We'll give you an escort of Paramecium ships as far as the upper level. After that, you'll be on your own.
Very good. Whenever you give the signal, Captain, Lavin can order the diatoms to proceed.
The sandbar is clear for the initial climb. Your course is straight up the stem of Water Plant 6. Diatoms ready?
Diatoms ready, sir.
Cilia in motion?
Cilia in motion.
Internal water circulators on?
Circulators on.
Countdown for takeoff. Five.
Five.
Four.
Four.
Three.
Three.
Two.
Two.
One.
One.
Zero.
Diatoms in motion. Full speed ahead.
Good luck.
Well, Char, this is the beginning of your dream.
If the ship holds.
We've utilized every engineering principle known to man. Double construction of the toughest water lily, 2,000 living diatoms for power, 20 million suns.
I'm not worried about the power. I'm worried about the temperature and the impact when we reach the surface film.
What's our speed?
20,000 knots.
Well, we've reached water plant 6. Now for the climb up the stem to the surface. Overseer.
Overseer.
Request more mucus from diatoms. Proceed with climb up stalk 6.
Yes, sir.
If the diatoms can hold the stalk at the reduced pressure of the surface, we'll have hurdled the first barrier.
We're at pressure 6 now, almost at the upper level.
Captain?
Yes?
We've lost 27 diatoms. Ciliary detachment.
Not serious. We have the Vorti to fall back on. Proceed.
Yes, sir.
What's our pressure?
3 coming into 2 now.
We're already closer to the surface film than man has ever gone.
Our unmanned test ships went through.
Unmanned test ships are a different story, Lavin. Besides, if we do get through to the other side, our problems may just be starting.
Oh, we're entering pressure 1 zone.
Yeah. We're getting too much oxygen in the water.
Engineer, switch to internal water supply for breathing.
Lavin.
What is it?
The scopes, look.
I can't look now. What is it?
I think... Yes, I can see it. I can see the surface film.
Describe it.
A great black whirling mass. Huge boulders and asteroids being whirled and ground back and forth like some tremendous boiling mass of mud and stone.
It isn't too late to turn back.
No, the ship was built to go through the film. If we fail, at least we can die knowing we tried.
Very well, sir. Overseer, order all diatoms. Full speed ahead.
Full speed ahead. Full speed ahead.
Film, Char.
Pressure on the ship is increasing.
Overseer, more oxygen for the diatoms.
Captain, the diatoms are dying.
More oxygen. Keep moving. We're almost through. Char, use the auxiliary Vorti. Maybe the motion of their cilia and the thrust of the water.
Overseer, bring up the Vorti. Full speed ahead.
We're moving. We're making headway. Off the ship will only hold together.
Char,
we're through. We're on the surface. Open the viewing port.
It's blinding. Put on your eye shield.
Look. Look, Char. Like a huge sheet of metal stretching as far as the eye can see, with thousands of small streams and great rivers of water.
Look above us, Lavin. Space. Space as far as one can see. And a single huge sun like a great eye looking down at us. Must be billions of miles above us.
See those enormous boulders and that molten rock on the surface?
The ancients did not lie when they made the plates, Lavin. The universe does exist beyond the surface.
Yes, but where are your creators, Char? Certainly, they were a romantic notion.
I believe they exist, Lavin.
Char!
Captain, the diatoms are dying. There's not enough oxygen in the water cases.
What's the atmosphere like?
Almost 30% oxygen, completely unbreathable.
We'll have to try to get back into the surface film to restore life to the diatoms. Overseer, get the diatoms out of their shells. Full reverse speed down the stalk. We're going under again.
Yes, sir. I'll try.
We know one thing, Lavin. The surface can sustain life.
Can't sustain ours much longer. Full reverse.
It's no use, Captain. The diatoms are near death.
Use the Vorti.
We haven't enough water, sir. They're starting to suffocate.
We've got to get back beneath the surface.
Lavin, we must. Think of what it means to mankind to know that the universe goes on, that it can sustain life.
I don't know what to do, Shaw. We're finished.
There must be a way.
A way? Why don't you pray to your creators now? Perhaps they'll help you. And as for me, I'm resigned to death.
I cannot share your bitterness, Lavin.
We have enough water for perhaps 2 minutes breathing, sure. There are no miracles and no creators. You'd better prepare to die.
I am as ready as you, Lavin.
Captain, we're strangling.
Well, sir, why don't you pray to the creators? Better still, let me. I have a louder voice. Hey, creators! You all-powerful ones who made us! Can you hear me? This is Captain Lavin of the first ship to breach the surface. We need your help. Can you hear me? We need your help.
If there be creators, and I believe there are, then I ask that our presence be noted and that we be delivered from this trial not for ourselves, but for the good of the race.
Well, Doctor?
The ship has emerged from the film and is lying on the surface. There is no movement now.
Probably strangling from lack of water.
Very likely.
What are you going to do?
It's a pity they can't get back again. Eventually, they may have to learn to live on the surface when the temperature changes.
Why not help them? You've played God before.
Why not, indeed? Switch on the electron magnet.
Ready.
Now then, if I can just breach the surface tension near them, they'll be sucked under again, as in a whirlpool. If they survive...
You'd better hurry.
Here goes.
Can't live much longer, Charlie.
No. It's getting... What? What's that?
I don't know.
We're moving.
Downward.
Slavin, it's a vortex. A vortex is opening through the surface.
One way or another, we'll die. The ship can't take the stress.
We're dropping.
Char.
Slavin, we're through. We made it. The water is circulating again.
It's too much to believe, Char. It's like...
A miracle.
Yes. It is a miracle. Well, Doctor?
They've gotten through. The ship is floating down toward the bottom now.
I wonder what they thought at the moment they were saved. Must have seemed to them as if the hand of God reached out to help them.
Very likely.
Do you suppose they prayed?
To whom would they pray?
I don't know. Perhaps to us, to the creators.
It is not inconceivable. If only the human race, as we know it, had creators who could reach down and save us from destruction.
How do you know we don't?
Professor, I'm a scientist.
So am I, Doctor. Those submicroscopic humans can't see us because we're too big to see. A molecule of our flesh would be like a world to them. And yet, we exist. We cannot hear their individual voices, perhaps, but we are capable of intervention of a sort. Is it not conceivable that our own plight might not be seen and recognized? What else is there at this time but to admit our inadequacy and to cast off this arrogance that gives us bitter pride instead of humility?
Where are you going, Professor?
To pray, Doctor. There isn't much time.
Professor.
Yes?
Wait. I will come with you.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features Jackpot by Clifford D. Simak. After years of searching, they had discovered the richest strike in the whole galaxy. But what in the name of space was it? Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you Surface Tension, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by James Blish and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Louis Van Ruten, Danny Ocko, Lawson Zerbe, Larry Haynes, Mason Adams, James Stevens, and Robert Hastings. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Scott Buckley and is an NBC Radio Network production.
X-1 on Tuned 2 yesterday from August 28, 1956 on NBC. The story we just heard was originally written by James Blish, who would later become known for his adaptations of Star Trek episodes from television to print. From 1967 through the mid-1970s, he would adapt episodes, make some changes here and there, and release them as books with hardcover editions in the mid-1970s. The story we just heard would be his only, adapted during radio's golden age on the air. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVillier. Now an author who is adapted often on Dimension X and X-1, Murray Leinster, has one of his stories featured on Exploring Tomorrow. From January 15, 1958, marking program number 9 for the Mutual Broadcasting System series, it's his tale, First Contact.
Now step into the incredible, amazing future as we go exploring tomorrow. And now here is your guide to these adventures of the mind, John Campbell, Jr.
For many years, a lot of us have been interested in considering the possibilities of meeting other life forms, other intelligent beings from other stars. Now, if there is life out there, some form of life, and remember, it may be beyond our most far-fetched imaginations. If there is life, and we have our own Earth ships going out in constant, regular deep space exploration, someday, somewhere, maybe even out in the gas cloud of the Crab Nebula, sometime we will meet.
Stepper, stepper, the scanner. Maximum. Maximum magnification.
Maximum mag.
More, more.
Sorry, sir, max is mag.
You see?
Can you see?
Not visibly.
Clear it, clear it.
Clear it, sir.
Step up the scanner. Step it up. Don't you understand? I've got to see.
Nothing. According to the reading, Captain, nothing, sir.
Sir, Captain, hold it. On the bow quarter.
Huh? Solid object.
80,000 miles, sir. 1 o'clock. Unknown object changing. Changing. 12 o'clock.
Sound collision.
Make ready, Mr. Dort.
Now hear this. Now hear this. The captain will now address the ship.
First, you've heard the collision alarm. You will all now take action stations. Man all weapons. Condition of extreme alert. Red. I repeat, red in all departments. Instrumentation tells us there is an unknown solid object less than 80,000 miles dead as we go. There is a locator beam on us. I repeat, there is an unknown locator on us, giving us unexpected feedback echo. Men, we are not a warship. May the Almighty be with us. That is all.
Mister?
Nothing, sir. Now I see nothing on the busy place.
Oh.
But radio locator. Here, look at it, sir.
Up and down, up and down.
Oh, something monstrous. Monster in size, sir. Making lunatic dashes toward us.
At collision speeds.
Then skipping away at the same fantastic speed.
We are not a warship.
Here it comes. There it goes away again. All on radio locate. On busy plate by eye, nothing. Can't detect a thing.
How many solar systems in our galaxy? How many? How many planets fit for life? And how many kinds of life could there be? If this ship isn't from Earth, and it isn't, it has a crew that isn't human. And things that aren't human but are up to the level of deep space travel in their civilization could mean anything.
Yes, sir.
Something like this has been talked about and speculated about for years. Mathematically, it's been an odds-on bet that somewhere in our galaxy there'd be another race with a civilization equal to or further advanced than ours. Nobody could ever guess where or when we'd meet them. It looks like we've done it now.
Well, do you suppose they'll be friendly, Captain?
Thank the Almighty for the blasters.
Here they come in for us fast again, sir.
Oh! Pulling away again. Yes, I can read the beam.
If you'll pardon, sir, the blasters are for meteorites, sir. They were never, were they, designed as space weapons?
They can serve as pretty good ones. Because we don't know what they're like, you fool! And we can't take a chance. We can't trust them the fraction of an inch. Sure, I know. Let's try and find out all we can about them. Let's meet. Let's try to be friends with that ship out there. Well, we don't. And you realize why? Because they have locators. Because they might trace us all the way back home without our knowing it. And we can't risk a non-human race knowing where Earth is unless we're sure of them. And how can we be sure? Do you know, Mr. Dort? Do you know, Mr. Dort, with your sentimental Pollyanna slush pile that calls itself your brain, your mind?
Unidentified object retreating against our locator, sir.
Back and forth. Back and forth the game goes on. They're afraid. We're afraid. Oh, sure. They could come to trade, of course. Import, export. That wouldn't hurt. Or maybe these creatures will be aesthetic marvels, nice and friendly and polite and underneath the Tojo type. But am I going to risk the possible future of the human race on a guess that it's safe to trust them? The one thing I won't risk is having them know how to find Earth. Either I know they can't follow me or I don't go home. And they probably feel the same way. Ready to ship for supplemental command.
There, sir. By sight, on the busy plate.
I see it. For the first time by eye. It's a small...
No, sir. It's bigger and bigger.
Bulb. Bulbous shape, like a pear.
Headed for us at extremely high acceleration, sir.
Hard
about, sir.
Put us about. He's crossing the T. Pass me a relay. Put a relay key to the blasters. Direct to the blasters under my hand.
This is the captain. Ready, blasters. Collision course with unidentified space object. Maximum power. Ready, blasters, section one. This is it, men.
Exploring Tomorrow continues in just a moment.
All of us, as American citizens, believe in our inherent liberties and freedoms, such as the freedom of the individual to choose and elect his own national representatives. It has been said that there is only one ruling class in America, the people themselves, who, through their vote, have established the law of our land. The real importance of this freedom depends on our accepting the responsibility not only to know what we are voting for or against, but also to choose our leaders for the best interests of the nation. So, accept your responsibility and ensure your freedom.
Two spaceships, two scientific expeditions, each uncountable miles from their own home. One from Earth. One from where?
The other ship stopped, Captain. Cut power. Quite stationary, sir.
Captain to crew. Steady as you are. Unidentified space object now stationary. Do not fire. I repeat, fire only on command. This is a trick. You will fire only on command from myself and only when verified. As you are.
Stop dead, sir. They are. Dead for sure. Have a look.
How far do you make them?
Range 20 miles, Captain. Now they're sending modulated shortwave at us, sir.
Frequency modulated?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I see your needle. Apparently a signal. Not enough power to do any harm.
Look up in the left bow busy plate, sir. There's something now.
Yes. I see movement on the outside of their hull. Their coal black hull. We shine like a mirror. Did you ever hear of a jet black spaceship, mister?
We want to reflect the sun. Perhaps they...
Want or need to absorb heat from a passing sun. Yeah, I know. Now, what's that thing?
Small, round, whatever it is. It's coming out of the side of the ship.
Watch.
Huh?
You're dripping sweat on your instruments.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir.
Yes, I realize what they're up to. They sent anything toward us, it might seem a projectile or a bomb. So they come close, let out a lifeboat, and go away again. Figure we can send a boat or a man to make contact without risking our whole ship, too.
Captain, that means they think...
Pretty much as we do. Yes, I'm glad that finally occurred to you. Mr. Dort, by the law of space command, I'm not allowed to leave my ship except to jettison. Mr. Dort, this is not an order.
No, sir.
And would you care to go out and look the thing over, whatever it is?
The alien ship continued to retreat. 40, 80, 400 miles. It came to a stop and hung out there, waiting. Earthman Tommy Dort, climbing into his atomic-driven spacesuit inside the airlock, heard this mileage report and felt safer, but just a little bit safer. The unknown black space intruder had stopped its retreat at 400 miles. He reasoned it might not have weapons effective at a greater distance. But Tommy felt lonely and a little expendable, speeding toward that tiny black dot which hung in the incredible brightness of the star gas. 4,000 light years from his wife and family and home. Speeding toward that tiny black spot, the only solid object he could see in all this glowing space. And then he landed. It was a slightly distorted sphere, not much over 6 feet in diameter. There were small tentacles or horns projecting from this black space orange. They looked rather like the detonating horns of an old-era submarine mine, but there was a glint of crystal at the tip of each. Then through his suit, he began to feel vibrations. The section of the rounded hull beneath his feet opened up. He moved sideways fast. It opened up and out, and when he looked inside into the now open insides of the little sphere, no, he didn't see the first non-human civilized beings he expected. What he saw was simply a flat plate, and on that flat plate, a dim red glow of light came and went. Even inside the protection of his spaceship, Tom Dort felt the hairs in his neck rise and bristle. In momentary terror, he pressed his sleeve button switch communicator.
Very good, Mr. Dort. Don't panic. No need to panic. Fix your scanner to look into that plate. Ah, Harry, these creatures are our equal.
But sir...
They dumped out a robot with an infrared visiplate for communication, is all. Not risking any personnel. Good SOP for them. Whatever we might do would only damage machinery. That's good. That means they value life as you value yours. Maybe, though, they expect us to pull you with a sphere in on board. It may have a bomb charge that can be detonated when they're ready to blow for their own home. I'll send a visiplate out with a man to face one of its scanners. You return to the ship. Well done, Dort.
Yes, sir. But which way is the ship?
Head straight away from the double star. We'll pick you up, Dort.
A tiny black bulbous robot floated in space between two spaceships. Ours and theirs. Represented a culture, theirs, which was at least up to ours. Now our two races could be friends. We could also be deadly enemies. We were a monstrous menace to them, and they to us. And the only safe thing to do with a menace is, of course, to destroy it.
This truce. Weeks and weeks. It started to get the crew.
I'm busy. Still calculating, Captain.
Let's see. Where was I in thinking? How do we establish friendship without risk of treachery? Friendship is based upon confidence. Or is it? Can confidence be established in a foundation of necessarily complete distrust?
If you can be patient a bit longer, sir, I think I've figured out a way we can talk their language. I mean, communicate. Since they seem to be stone deaf.
You can.
I think, sir.
You can?
I believe now, sir, we can say almost anything we wish to them and understand what they say back. But of course, sir, you'll never be able to know how much of what they say is the truth.
Well, neither will they about us. Go on, mister.
Well, I've managed to hook up what amounts to a mechanical translator. We showed them our recorder in the vision plates, and they showed us theirs. They record the FM direct, I think. Now, they don't use sound at all, even in speech. My guess is, sir, that they use microwaves for what you might call person-to-person conversation. I think they make shortwave trains as we make sounds.
Telepathy?
Yes, sir. I think, sir. I'm ready if you are. If you are, that is, prepared to talk with their skipper.
Turn on your mechanical translator. What? What shall I say to them, Dort? What shall I say?
They're waiting. They keep sending something like a CQ.
Ah.
They're
They're oxygen produced, sir, and they appear not too dissimilar in certain ways. I'm sure I detected signs of irony.
Iron?
I mean, sir, that implies humor. In other words, sir, I think they could be likable.
All right. Send this.
Aye, aye, sir. They're acting suspicious.
All right. Say, the appropriate things about this first contact of two dissimilar but civilized races, and of my hope that a friendly intercourse between the two peoples will result.
Excuse, sir. What appropriate things? Oh, just a second, sir. The skipper sends you the following, quote, "That is all very well, but is there any way for us to let each other go home alive? I would be happy to hear of such a way, if you can contrive one. At the moment, it seems to me that one of us must be killed." Unquote.
All right, then. Send this. Look here out there, whoever you are. It looks like we have to fight, and one batch of us gets killed. All right, we're ready if we have to. But if you win, we've got it fixed so you'll never find out where Earth is. And there's a good chance we'll get you anyhow. We stayed here a month, and we've swapped information, and we don't hate each other. There's no reason for us to fight, except to protect our races.
Well, he says, sir, yes, all you say is true, but that his race has to be protected just as you feel that yours must be. He says, quote, "Perhaps this will help us to think clearly. Suppose we make it so we can't find each other's home planet, but leave a way to communicate in the future. So work out grounds for a common trust. If our governments want to be fools, let them. But we should give them the chance to make friends instead of starting a space war out of mutual panic," unquote.
All right, I have it. Send this. Okay, sir. Whoever you are, let's swap spaceships.
Send it, send it.
He answers, "Interesting. What is rest of your swapping proposal?"
Send this. Swap ships and crews. I remove all star charts and anything else evidential. He removes all his navigational records. We train each other's key crewmen, and I go for home with my crew and his ship. He goes for home with his crew and his ship. That's my proposal. Tell him that's final. If he refuses, I'll blast.
Hold on, please, sir. He says, accepted. He says, accepted. With one proviso that we arrange to meet here, at this star fix, in exactly one astronom of the double star.
Agreed. To us, that'll be a year. Send it.
Now hear this. Now hear this. On signal, prepare to abandon ship. We sail for home as soon as we have learned to man controls of unidentified space object. And good Godspeed to us all. We will all see Earth again as soon as we are trained and we train them.
Hidden assumption in the story we just heard that any intelligent entity can and may lie. I wonder just what a lie is and why it is that we expect intelligent entities to lie. Could a machine lie? Could an intelligent machine lie? Well, next time we have a discussion on that that I think you'll find interesting. It's called Liar.
Fascinating adventure in Exploring Tomorrow. Heard in our cast tonight were Lon Clark and Lawson Zerbe. Script was by Murray Leinster, adapted by Peter Irving. Produced and directed by Sanford Marshall here in New York. Bill Maher speaking.
We pause now for station identification.
Exploring Tomorrow on Tuned to Yesterday from January 15th, 1958 on the Mutual Broadcasting System. And so closes this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you.